Hello, and welcome to the Church on the Hill podcast. If you enjoy this podcast, we invite you to join us live this Sunday at 500 Sands Drive in San Jose, California. Visit churchonthehill.com for service times and directions, and also to learn more about connecting, growing, and serving at Church on the Hill. Now, please enjoy our sermon at Church on the Hill.
So sometime around the year 1945, in the state of North Dakota, there was supposed to be this big event, this big boxing match, and it was a fight to declare the Gold Gloves champion of the state of North Dakota. So the two best fighters in the entire state were to show up, go toe-to-toe, and one of them would get crowned the Gold Gloves champ, the best fighter in the state. But what happened on that night was one of the fighters climbed into the ring and he backed into his corner and he looked across to the other corner and it was empty. The other guy didn't show up. They just didn't come. I don't know the reason why they just didn't show. But the people putting on this event realized that all this audience, this whole crowd, they came here to see a fight and they want to see a boxing match, so we can't just cancel this thing. So they decided to ask the audience for a volunteer to step in and fight the trained professional. And this young man in the crowd, I don't know whether he put his hand up or whether his friends forced his hand into the air, but either way, he was chosen to come down and fight for the Gold Gloves Championship. So this person that expected to be a spectator in street clothes goes walking down, climbs into the ring. They put someone else's gloves on his hand. They put him in the corner. They ring the bell, and they say, "Fight." And the guy goes out to the center of the ring, creeps in, throws a right hook, plants it directly on the jaw of the professional, and lays him out cold. In the street clothes wearing someone else's glove is now the Gold Gloves champion of the entire state. Now, I cannot tell you everything about that man. I can't tell you exactly how tall he was. I cannot tell you what his parents' names were. I cannot tell you the exact city or town he was born in. I can't tell you how many siblings or if he had siblings or their names. But what I can tell you is this. That man was my grandpa. And my grandpa could tell a story. I don't know if all of them were true. And I have a lot of them if you want to hear them later. They're great. But the reason why I bring that up this morning is this. My grandpa has since passed. And a lot of the details of his life, the facts and the information, I have not held on to all that well. But the stories that he told me, I can still remember where we were sitting for most of them when he told me those stories. And so this morning, as we're in this time, as we're taking a look at this series, the parables of Jesus, what we're looking at are the stories that Jesus told that have a bigger meaning. That's what a parable is. But we frequently ask the question, why did Jesus so often tell stories? Why did he frequently use parables? When someone asked him a question, why didn't he just respond with the facts and the information? And the reason is this. Jesus knew thousands of years ago what science tells us today, and that is if you want someone to remember something, if you want it to stick with them, put it in the form of a story and attach emotion to it. Don't just use facts and information. So as we ask the question, why did Jesus often communicate some important principles and the things he wanted to stick with us, why did he communicate those in the form of a story? It's because it worked better. Because when he wanted us to remember something and he wanted it to stick and it was important, he knew way back then, he knew how we're wired and he knew how we were made, and he knew if we were going to have it stick with us, it had a lot better chance if it were in the form of a story. So now we get to take a look at the parables or the stories of Jesus. And that's this series that we've been in. Now, we're going to be in Luke chapter 15, and Jesus gives three parables right in a row. But before we get into that, I want to tell you guys a story from my time here at the church. If you don't know who I am, my name's Josh, and I'm the community groups pastor and also the student ministries pastor here at the church. And my grandpa's a legend, so I got that going for me. But I've had an incredible amount of times where I get to be a part of significant stories and life change and these incredible things in my job here at the church, and I absolutely love that part of my job. But the problem is, rarely can I get up here and tell you the story, because usually it's very personal for somebody, and rightfully so, they don't want me going in front of hundreds of people and telling their story. But this morning, I got permission, so you get to hear it. And I will give you a very, very condensed version of one of the highlights for me of my time as the high school pastor here at the church. It was about 2 years ago, and in my role, I usually get to have an intern who works with me in the high school ministry, and they do a lot of significant and important ministry with all the students, and so this is a big role for me. And one of them was transitioning out, and I was trying to hire a new one, and I could not find the right person for the life of me. So I'm praying about this, and I'm asking God, like, give me guidance and give me wisdom on this. Help me find someone. And in my head when I pray, on a reoccurring basis, I kept getting this feeling, check with Justin. And I'm like, Lord, that can't be right. The reason why that didn't seem right to me was Justin was a kid that had come through the group and rarely went to the group. He didn't go any camps with us. He wasn't a part of any of our major events. He had graduated like a year prior and was currently going to West Valley. And as far as I knew, which I was pretty convinced I was right, he was not living life in a way that would be your prototypical church intern. Does that make sense for everyone? Are we on the same page there? And so as I thought about this, I'm like, Lord, that doesn't make sense. But again and again, there was different confirmations. And so finally I decided, okay, I'm going to hire Justin. We're going for it. And the cool thing that took place was about a year later, give or take, I got to stand in the back as Justin was speaking to the high school students, and he said, before I get started and before I give you guys this message, I just want to say thank you. You guys may or may not know this, but when I took this job, I was doing life in a way where I was definitely not making the wisest choices, and I was headed down a road that was not going to take me to a good place. And he said, I even knew at the time I was not making good choices and I was not doing the things that were going to lead to a good place, but for some reason, I just kept doing it. I just kept going down that road, and it wasn't until he took the job and reconciled his life to Christ and changed the things he was doing, changed his priorities, and restored his relationship with God, and he came back home, that he was able to stand in front of the students and say, the difference for me now is I can say, I don't know for sure where my life would have been had I stayed down that road, but I would say that this thing has saved my life, and I'm in a completely direction now, and there's a completely different future and a completely different hope for me. And I love that story. And if you're a believer in the room, I'm guessing you love that story too, because you understand what it is to have the creator of the universe forgive you of your sins, reconcile you, bring you into relationship with him, shower you with his love, his grace, and his forgiveness, and to comfort you and to give you that peace that lets you know, though there will be ups and downs in life, though there will be hard times and there will be good times, I know that my creator has a plan for me, and he's got me, and he's walking through this with me. And if you know that, then of course you're excited when you hear a story like that. Of course you like hearing a story about someone who was lost and then was found and reconciled. And this morning, we are in Luke 15, and that is exactly what we're talking about. The three stories, the three parables we find in Luke 15 have the exact same outline in all three of them. There is something that was lost, and then it's found. There's something lost, and then it's found, and there's something lost, and then it's found. So let's take a look at it. And the context for it is this. The Pharisees, or the so-called religious leaders of the time, are kind of complaining about how Jesus continuously hangs out with the people he's not supposed to hang out with. He's with the bad people and the sinners and the tax collectors, and he's eating at their homes, and he's doing all these things he's not supposed to be doing. And so they're kind of complaining about what Jesus is choosing to do. So in response to their complaints, Jesus says this to them in verse 4. He says, "Suppose one of you has 100 sheep and loses one of them. Doesn't he leave the 99 in the open country and go after the lost sheep until he finds it? And when he finds it, he joyfully puts it on his shoulders and goes home. Then calls his friends and neighbors together and says, 'Rejoice with me, I have found my lost sheep.'" And then he explains it in verse 7. "I tell you that in the same way, there will be more rejoicing in heaven over one sinner who repents than over 99 righteous persons who do not need to repent." And what Jesus is doing here is he's calling out these religious leaders. He's saying, you're supposed to be the ones leading these people. And if you're supposed to lead them, those are your sheep. You are their shepherd. This is the flock you're supposed to take care of. And he says, if you were a shepherd and one of your sheep strayed off, wouldn't you go get it? And this is not a genuine question where Jesus is asking, like, so would you go, if you were a shepherd and your sheep leaves, do you think you'd go search for him, or do you think you'd go try to find it? This is a rhetorical question, and Jesus is putting an indictment on these religious leaders, saying, you're supposed to care for your sheep. That's your job. That's the whole point of what you're supposed to do. And if your sheep leaves, you're supposed to go search for it. And he's calling out these leaders at the time, going, not only are you not searching for those that are lost, sometimes you're making it harder that when they try to come back, you make it difficult for them to even come back. And he's calling out these religious leaders, going, it's not how it's supposed to be. And in my research of this passage, something else that I found out was that apparently, when sheep leave the herd, they frequently don't even try to come back. They leave, they get lost, and then apparently they're just kind of quitters, and they lay down and just give up. Just, that's it. And so part of the imagery I think we find here is it says when the shepherd finds the sheep, he picks it up and puts it on his shoulders and carries it back. And Jesus is calling out these religious leaders going, you're supposed to be searching and helping them back. What are you doing? The next thing we see is this. He comes back, and then there's a party upon return. Now, in this context, would there have been a party for just one sheep coming back? No. What Jesus is doing is he's exaggerating a point so that they see something, and he's exaggerating this idea of if something is lost, when it comes back, there should be a celebration. And then you move on to the next one. And it's the woman with the coins, and I'm not going to read the whole thing. I'll just summarize it for you guys. And it's the woman has 10 coins. She loses one in her house, and she turns the whole house over. She lights the lamp. She cleans the house. She searches as much as she can until she finally finds the coin. And then when she finds it, she calls her friends over and has a celebration. And then the explanation says this in verse 10. In the same way, I tell you, there is rejoicing in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner who repents. And then we come to the third story or the third parable. And it's a little bit more common. Some of you might have heard it before. It's the parable of the lost sons, and it says this. There was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, "Father, give me my share of the estate." So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country, who sent him to the field to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare? And here I am starving to death. I will set out and go back to my father and say to him, 'Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired hands.' So he got up and went to his father. But while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to him, Father, I have sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. But the father said to his servants, Quick, bring the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. So they began to celebrate. Then it continues on. Meanwhile, the older son was in the field. When he came near the house, he heard music and dancing, so he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. Your brother has come, he replied, and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound. The older brother became angry and refused to go in, so his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders. Yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours who has squandered your property with prostitutes comes home, you kill the fattened calf for him. My son, the father said, you are always with me and everything I have is yours. But we had to celebrate and be glad because this brother of yours was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found. So three stories, three parables, stacked one after another. Lost, found. Lost, found. Lost, found. And if parables were Jesus' way of getting something to stick because it was important, if there was something that he wanted us to take, he would tell it in the story. So our question this morning is this: what is it that Jesus is trying to communicate in these three parables? And I think the first thing that we see is this. If you are a follower of Christ in the room, you are called to have a heart like Christ and to try to live like Christ. And in this parable, I think it's absolutely clear that if you are a follower in the room, you are supposed to have a heart for those that are lost. Not just to say that you care, not just to go, yeah, that's neat, we should do programs and service things, but to sacrifice of yourself, to search and to seek those that are lost, and to give yourself to those things, to put effort in towards those things. And as I was thinking about this, I was trying to figure out how to make this as tangible and as applicable as possible. How can we take this home and really apply this? Because the truth is that I think often we want to have a Christ-like heart, and sometimes we do, and sometimes we have a religious heart even though we don't want to. And so I wanted to just have a list to kind of compare and contrast the two ideas. So the first thing I came up with was when someone is lost, for us to have a Christ-like heart in dealing with that person, we go and we talk to them. We have a conversation with people that are lost, and we ask them how they're doing. We engage with them, and we listen for their stories. We allow them to be heard, and we don't try to direct the conversation to this place where we want it to go. We simply just get to know them and have a conversation and let them speak. But if you choose to have a religious heart, instead of talking to the people that are lost, you talk about people that are lost. You say things like, did you see the pictures that they posted on their social media account? Do they not realize other people can see those? I'm pretty sure in their profile it actually lists them as a Christian still, and I think they even went to this church. Did you see what they wore when they came into church? Or maybe you go, oh, did you see that person? I wonder what they were drinking last night. I bet that first set of music with all the bright lights and the loud bass drum, that's going to be a fun one for them to sit through. And we talk about people instead of talking to lost people. If we have a Christ-like heart, we invite someone in. We let them know that they're welcome, and we try to make it feel comfortable and inviting for them. If we have a religious heart, we simply just avoid them. We act like they're not there. We act like they don't exist. You just avoid them. If you have a Christ-like heart when you're talking to someone who is lost or dealing with someone who is lost, you let them know that you miss them. If they were once here and they've gone stray, You let them know that you liked it when they were here, that they had something to offer, that you liked what they offered, and that you notice that they're gone and that you miss having them around. If you have a religious heart, you let them know that they hurt you, that they betrayed you, that they wronged you, that when they left, it caused you problems. And you make it about yourself. If you have a Christ-like heart, you remind them of home and of hope. That there is a group of people, that there is a God that wants them back, that misses them, that has a place for them, that desires for them to be there, and that their story is not over and it is not done, and there's a hope and a future, and God has plans, and there's good things still ahead. If you have a religious heart, you clarify their sins. You make sure they know crystal clear exactly what they've done wrong in all the verses that support exactly how what they're doing is not right and how they have chosen to do evil or sin. And if you want to take it farther, you send them a little message, like an email, and then you put the verse at the bottom of it, and then you put the tagline, like, Jesus doesn't like you anymore. You probably wouldn't, but that's kind of what we're saying. The next thing that I think we see in the parable, not only are we supposed to have a heart for those that are lost, just like the shepherd who goes out and finds the sheep that's probably just pretty much quit and given up, he doesn't ask it to get up and walk back and to put in some effort of its own. He picks it up and puts it over his shoulders and walks him home to where he is supposed to be. So when someone comes home, when someone who is lost returns, how do we have a Christ-like heart and how do we have a religious heart? And please understand, my goal with these illustrations is not to just make us feel guilty. It's for us to understand that for almost all of us in the room, we have been the Christ-like heart and we have also been the religious heart. And we need to be aware of what we're doing. So when someone who is lost comes home, if you have a Christ-like heart, you celebrate the fact that they've come home. You realize that where they were going was not a good thing and it wasn't what God had intended and it wasn't the best life for them. And now they're going someplace different and they get to have reconciliation and restoration with God. And that's incredible. So you celebrate it. If you have a religious heart, you let them know that it's now time to pay their debts. That they wronged a lot of people. That they hurt a lot of people, that they burnt a lot of bridges, and now it's time for them to start putting in some work to try to restore those things. When someone comes home to have a Christ-like heart, you let them know that there's hope. You let them know that you think their return is going to stick, that you think their entire life might actually be different from this point. You let them know that there's hope and a future and that God has a design for them and a plan for them and that he's not given up and that their story is not over. It is not the final chapter yet. You remind them of people like Paul and you say, look at what Saul did and then he became Paul. Don't think just because the start was rough or because there were some bumpy patches that you're done. You keep hope and you give them hope. To have a religious heart, you stay skeptical. You say things like, yeah, they might be back now, but I bet they don't even have the right motives. I bet as soon as they get what they want, as soon as things get back to settled, or as soon as things get back to good, they'll be gone again. Yeah, they might have returned, but I bet it's just an emotional high, and as soon as the emotion wears off, there's no chance that they're sticking around. Or how many times have we told them where we are and yet it took them this long to come back? The next thing. If you have a Christ-like heart when someone comes back, you greet them warmly. Like the father who goes out to his son before he even says anything, he gives him a hug and a kiss and he lets him know that he's glad that he's back. He lets him know that this is where he wants him. To have a religious heart, You wait for an apology. You make sure they know good and well that they wronged you and they hurt you, and until they say that they're sorry, there will not be restoration. And it is on them to fix things, and you will wait for that apology. Next thing. When you have a Christ-like heart and someone returns, you let them know that they are forgiven. You don't say it didn't hurt. You didn't say it didn't cause trouble. You don't do any of that. But you let them know because Christ forgave you, you choose to forgive them. And both you and Christ have forgiven them. And it is time to move on and to look to the future, not to look back. To have a religious heart, you let them know it's time to prove themselves. That they lost all trust and all credibility, and now it's time to try to do everything they can to try to restore some of that, and we'll see what happens. And the last one, when someone who has lost comes home, you are joyful that they came back. You're excited that they now get to have a right relationship with God, and you're excited that they were once going to a place that you knew was not good, and now they're not. And they have found forgiveness and reconciliation, and they get to start this next chapter, and you're excited and joyful to see what God has in store for. But to have a religious heart, you take the position of the older son. And you say, I'm not going into the party. Because he did all those things wrong and he messed up everything. And now he thinks he gets to come back and have the same standing as me. I've been here this entire time doing everything right and it's not fair. So you get bitter. And someone returns and you're bitter about it. Now the next thing to me that really stands out in these three stories, or these three parables, to me is the most important one. I think the religious heart and the Christ-like heart are absolutely rooted in this. I think this is the foundation for every other piece. I think this is humongous for how we see ourselves and how we see others. And it's absolutely clear in these three parables. And what we see is this. We see the character of our God. There are so many of us that one way or another have become so convinced that God is just deeply disappointed in us. We are hard set on the belief that we are just a failure who continues to come up short over and over and over again. And even though Scripture says not to, and we're told to make God a priority, and we're told to do all these different things, we fail and we fail and we fail, and we're convinced that God is just sick of us and that he's disappointed in us and that he's pretty much given up on us because we've messed up so many times. We convince ourselves that every single time we sin, he's looking down going, really? You're going to do that one again? It's the same one. And then you make progress, and he goes, oh, look, you got a different sin, and you brought in that new shiny toy, and now we're doing this one too. And we're convinced that he's just frustrated and annoyed, and he's sitting up there in heaven going, oh, I should have just sank the ark and been done with it. Should have just wiped him out. And my question for you is, if we believe that about our God, then why would we ever come back to him? Why would we ever come home if we're convinced that God is just waiting to berate us and, like a bad puppy, stick our snout in the mess we've made and smack our bottom and go, look at the mess you've made for me. Would you just knock it off? If that's how we see God, why would we ever want to come back to him? And if that's the image we give to other people, and if that's what we portray to others, why would anyone else ever want to come home? Why would anyone want that, and why would we want that if that's what we hold is our view of God? And so what's so incredibly important to me is that we see God represented in these three stories. He's the shepherd with the sheep. He's the woman searching for the coin, and he's the father going out to both of his sons. It is so clear in this passage, God is not saying he is done with you. He is not saying that he's given up on you. Instead, he is the one that runs out to the sheep. And when he finds the sheep, even though it's probably not the best sheep because it ran away, and then once it ran away, it just quit and laid down. And he doesn't say, get up and put in some effort or get up and do this. He picks it up and he puts it over his shoulders and he brings it back home to where it's supposed to be. And then he throws a party to exaggerate the point. There is so much value in the lost coming back. And we see the heart of our God again with the coin as he turns over the entire house and searches for this one coin. And when it's found, there is yet again a party. And we see the heart of God when the lost son, who's done everything wrong and made all the bad choices, finally comes home. He runs out in the field, and before there's ever an I'm sorry or an explanation, there's a hug and a kiss because the father is simply glad that they came back. He just wanted them home. And when he launches into the thing of, Father, I've sinned and I've done everything wrong and I messed up and I blew everything, he goes, stop. Get the best robe in the house. Get the ring and put it on his fingers. Get the sandals and put it on his feet and kill the fattened calf because it's time to party because my son that was lost is now home. And even in the midst of the party and in the midst of the celebration, when the self-righteous older son is having his pity party out in the field and says, I'm not coming in, the father goes out to him and pleads with him and says, everything I have is yours. Come back. And we don't get to see what happens with the older brother, but what we absolutely clearly get to see in all three of these stories is the character of the God that we serve. And it is of the utmost importance that we understand how God receives the lost. Because if we think we're coming back to an angry father who's just going to berate us, we're not coming home. And we will not convince others to come home either. But if we understand that our God is the one running in the field and turning over the house and accepting both sons and doing everything he can to bring you back because he simply wants you home, it changes everything. And the last thing that I see is this. In every single one of these stories, exaggerated in the first two, impossible in the third, is this principle. When the lost are found, it is not time to pay dues, and it is not time to pay off debts. It is clearly time to celebrate. It is now time to party. And even for the angels and the heavenly hosts, it is absolutely worthy of celebration that when something that is lost is found, we are supposed to party and we are supposed to celebrate. We are supposed to have a depth of joy over that reconciliation, knowing that someone who is going down a path and going places that we would not hope for them has been restored and is now back to forgiveness and the grace and the love of our God. And we're supposed to celebrate that. So what we're going to do this morning as we close is I'm going to take time for us to celebrate. And because I want you guys to engage with this, I'm going to ask you to do something a little bit different. I'm going to ask you to just close your eyes, bow your heads, don't look around the room. And if you were part of that first group, if you look at your life and you realize I was making choices and I was going in a direction that was not going to lead to a very great ending for my life. If you see your lack of wisdom or you see your bad choices, you see just the fact that you were just lost and wandering or maybe the hard heart, whatever it is, if you see yourself there, and then you can look and go, but I have been redeemed. I have accepted the forgiveness and the love of Christ. If that is you, I want you to take a minute and just think about where would your life have gone had you never turned and come back to God? If you never came home to where you were supposed to be, what would your life look like now? And I want you to take a minute and compare and contrast your life and go, okay, if I never had and being that I have, what is the difference? And if that's you, then this morning I'd like you to raise your hand. If that's your story. If you're wondering, my hand is absolutely up. Okay. You guys can put your hands down. But I want you to celebrate by taking time to think about the difference that God has made in your life. Continuing to have your eyes closed and your heads bowed, the second group of you. If you have been a part of someone else's story, to the point that you know the details and you know that they were going places and making decisions that were not what was best for their life, and they changed and they turned around and there's been reconciliation, and you were closely or got to be a part of that story, if that's you, would you raise your hand? Okay. You know what I love about that one is even though your guys' heads are down and your eyes are closed and I can't really see you, I see the hands and I know that there is a smile on the face of those hands because one of the greatest things we get to do in our lives is be a part of the redemption of someone else's life. One of the greatest things we'll ever get to experience is being a part of someone else's life change and realizing their trajectory, their future, their whole life has now changed. So you can put your hand down, but if that's you, take some time and celebrate that. And the last group is this. And don't feel forced in this situation. If this isn't you, don't raise your hand. That's fine. But if this morning you're sitting here and you realize that you are still off in that far-off country and you're squandering and you're doing some things where you know I'm not making the right choices and I now need to turn and I need to come home and I need to come back to God. I need to repent and I need to have some reconciliation because I'm going to a place that I know I'm not supposed to be going and I'm choosing this morning to turn and come back from that. Whether it is your first time or whether you're doing this yet again, either way, would you raise your hand? For those of you that put your hand up for that one, I would ask you to share that with someone. If you don't have anyone to share it with, put it on a card in the back. Come tell me. I will absolutely celebrate that with you. But the point that I want to end with this morning is that there was a lot of hands that went up in this room. And what every single one of those hands mean is that we have something to celebrate and to be joyful about. Because our God chose to take a stance with us to redeem us and to give us forgiveness that we didn't earn. And we have to remember that our God is not just waiting to tell us all the things we've done wrong. He is the one that's striving after us, and his heart's desire is to have a relationship with us. And that is an incredible gift that we are supposed to celebrate. So this morning, I'm going to close us in prayer. And then the band's going to lead us in a song, and we will continue in our time of worship. Lord, I thank you so much for every person in this room. I thank you for the fact that you choose to pursue us and search for us. And Lord, when we're broken and we just feel like we're going to quit and lay down in the field, you pick us up on your shoulders and you walk us back home to where we're supposed to be. Lord, I thank you so much that when we get home, we don't just get to see all the things we've done wrong, but we have a Father who loves us and just wants to have that relationship with us. Lord, I ask that you would make this extremely clear in our minds and that when we run the idea of your disappointment, instead we would get a mental picture of you chasing after us in the field or embracing us like the lost son, Lord. That we would have a correct view of you and your love for us. And Father, I ask that we would celebrate that well. Amen.